Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett, and I'm very excited to have Dr. Michael Quinn on this show. He's one of the most well-known Mormon historians in all of contemporary Mormonism. We're going to talk about the Deseret Hemp Company. Now, that's a big topic. This fall here in Utah, there's going to be a ballot initiative to decide whether to legalize hemp or marijuana, especially medical marijuana. So, did you know that the LDS Church owned the Deseret Hemp Company? Yeah, it's the same thing. What did they use it for? Dr. Michael Quinn will answer that question in just a moment. Hey, I also want to remind everybody that we've got our latest transcripts with Dr. George Throckmorton and Sandra Tanner out. For our monthly subscribers, I'll be sending Sandra's out probably tonight, so you should be getting that in the mail quickly. So please remember to subscribe on our website. For $10 a month, I will give you the latest copy, and if you want to get 15, I'll give you a nice paperback copy like this. So that will be pretty awesome. So now back to our conversation. Well, welcome to Gospel Tangents Podcast. I'm really excited. I've got a real rare treat, Mike Quinn, historian Mike Quinn, here in Salt Lake City. So could you introduce yourself to the audience? You know, not everybody knows about Mormon history and might not know who you are. Can you give us a little bit of your background?
I was born in California, and while I was there, which we were always told was the mission field, I became interested in Mormon history as a hobby when I was 16. And then it became, when I was in the military and after I'd graduated from BYU in English literature, I had time to reconsider what I wanted to do as a graduate student while I was in the Army for 3 years. And I decided to switch to history because my hobby had become too consuming. So when I came out of the military, I went to the University of Utah to get a master's degree in history, and then I went from there to Yale. But before that, I served as a research and writing assistant to Leonard Arrington while he was the church historian. After I got my PhD in history from Yale, 3 months later, I was hired by the BYU campus to join its Department of History. And I remained there for 12 years. And then have been freelance historian, or the term is independent scholar in the field. Aside from occasional appointments, I had a 2-year appointment at the University of Southern California, and then I had a 1-year appointment at Yale University, and that was my last academic appointment more than a dozen years ago.
Oh, wow, that's cool. So for those who aren't familiar with your background, I know in the 1980s you wrote a chapter, I believe it was, in a Maxine Hanks book, is that right?
Yes, it was actually 1992 that it came out. Mm-hmm. It was called Mormon Women Have Had the Priesthood Since 1843. And that caused a certain amount of controversy.
Yeah, could you tell a little bit more about that?
Well, Maxine was excommunicated, I was excommunicated. And she was specifically told that she was excommunicated because of her book, and I was told, and I'd given a list of 3 items showing my apostasy, a list provided by the stake president, and the first item on the list was that essay.
Was that essay, okay. Mm-hmm. Now, so you're one of the, I guess, infamous September 6, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So the one thing that I think would strike most people as a little bit odd, I know I listened to your Radio West interview earlier this week, and you mentioned that you're still a believing Mormon. So some people might think, well, if you're excommunicated, why would you still believe in a church that would excommunicate you?
Well, I'm a 7th generation Mormon. Nothing can take that away from me. Mm-hmm. But even, you know, there are many, my children are 8th generation Mormons, and they talk about Mormons in the third person. They couldn't care less about the church. So the fact that I'm an ancestral Mormon doesn't determine my faith. And my faith is very basic, but it's basic in a way that I think many current members of the church might not understand. In many ways, I'm a 19th century Mormon believer. I believe in Joseph Smith meeting with angels and translating the Book of Mormon by the gift and power of God, which at that time was the seer stone. And I believe that the leaders of the church, from Joseph Smith to the current president of the church, have the calling of divine prophets, seers, and revelators who have the right to receive God's revelations. But they don't always do so, and sometimes they are too passive, in my view, and don't seek those revelations in a direct way. But in my view, they have the right and the obligation to receive those revelations. I don't agree with all the policies of the church, and some of them I strongly disagree with. And to that extent, although I did not seek excommunication, excommunication freed me from having to defend policies I thoroughly disagree with. And that continues to till today. So I maintain my faith in a private way. I'm in some ways like a Latter-day Saint medieval mystic. I have had this feeling even since childhood that it's just you and me, Lord, against the world. And God and my relationship with him was always preeminent. But the reason I always loved going to sacrament meeting and as I grew up, Sunday school, was that the communion was served at each of those opening services. And that was always very important to me. And that's one of the things that I miss deeply, as well as the temple. I used to be a temple worker in a variety of ways. I was a temple worker when I was a missionary. I was a temple worker while I was at BYU and scheduled worker. And so the loss of taking the sacrament every Sunday at least once and participating weekly as I used to in the temple ceremonies, that has been a deep loss. It's one that I miss all the time. But because I am kind of this mystic, I'm okay, and I don't worry about my relationship with God. But I'm no longer a member of the Church of Record. But that I'm still, no one can prevent me from believing what I believe.
So you still call yourself a Mormon, I guess.
I do, but I'm not a Latter-day Saint in the sense that I'm not a part of the LDS Church. Mm-hmm. So if people are attuned enough with the preferred language to ask if I'm LDS, I'll say I'm not a member, but I am a Mormon believer.
Okay. Have you ever considered the Community of Christ?
I've gone to a lot of churches and communions, and I love the people in the Community of Christ. As I love people in Jewish synagogue, I used to attend Jewish synagogue every Friday and then go to LDS services as well. And I love the communion of faith and heritage that is a part of synagogue, or the Jews say temple, going to temple. But I've never been comfortable in any other fellowship. And I really don't need organized religion for me to maintain my relationship with God. And so I've never really seriously considered joining any other fellowship, although I've been invited to.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Just a little confession. I actually, when I was on my mission, I went to South Carolina. Me and my companion attended a Jewish synagogue for about a month. It was pretty fun on Friday nights. So I got to meet the rabbi. He was a very nice fellow.
Well, they're very welcoming people, unless you try to go to Hasidic or Orthodox. And then you're one of the goyim. But it was very fun for me. I went to the, initially I started out as a teenager attending Reform Synagogue, which was the only one in the town or the city I grew up in. But then when I was attending every week in the military, it was a conservative synagogue, but they welcomed me and they gave me a very, very nice silk yarmulke to attend the services in, and always invited me to their bar mitzvahs, which you needed to attend by invitation, and they would invite me to those. And they were sweet people, and I really value the fellowship of Jewish people I've known over the years. But I've also enjoyed the fellowship of Muslims and of Catholics and of atheists. And so I have a broad-ranging acceptance of a variety of religious professions and religious ideologies. And I have a very broad sense of who God loves and who he doesn't. And in my view, he dislikes no one. He loves us all. He weeps for many of us much of the time, and for some of us all of the time. But having felt that way, I feel that I have an obligation as a sinner to embrace all other sinners, even the ones who turn my blood cold. And so I, even if I don't physically embrace them, I do emotionally.
Very interesting. So tell us why you're here in Salt Lake this week.
I've been scheduled by Signature Books to do a series of book talks and interviews like this about my most recent book, which is called Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth, and Corporate Power.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you about that. So I've actually, the interesting thing about that book is the narrative isn't that long. It's just three chapters. I was like, oh, I can pound through that pretty quickly. I didn't read all of the tables, though. How many pages are the tables?
The tables, I'm not sure. There are 17 tables, and most of them take at least half a page. One of them, or more, is a two-page spread. So on average, I'd say they maybe take around 15 pages of that 150 or so.
Yeah, there's only 150 pages of kind of narrative, and then there's probably 300 of just appendices and tables and everything like that. So the one thing I was leafing through, and I thought that one of the businesses had a very unusual name, the Deseret Hemp Company, and I thought, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit? Do you know very much about that?
Yeah, well, hemp was a textile, and people grew hemp the way they grew, trying to think of some other textiles that are flax or other things that could be used to make clothing. And Joseph Smith, by some of his neighbors, was described as a guy who wore hemp trousers, which were made from the plant, which was grown in the South generally, and then its final products were shipped north to manufacturing centers in Massachusetts. But in Utah, there was this idea that was economically wise, but it didn't always work out in practice, of Utah's residents being self-sufficient. And so in order to set up this self-sufficiency, Brigham Young, as church president, and for a period of time as governor, established a lot of missions with an economic basis. So there was a flax mission, there was a cotton mission, which of course also caused the textile industry in Utah to grow. And then there was a hemp growing process, although it wasn't exactly a hemp mission, but there were general authorities who were involved in the growing of hemp and its use in manufacturing shirts and trousers. And so that was similar. It was a similar kind of enterprise to the cotton mission that Brigham Young had established in southern Utah. But that lasted longer and it was more successful. And as far as I know, I have no evidence of anyone smoking any of the hemp.
That's what I was worried about.
No.
Okay. Do you know when that ended? That hemp?
It was a kind of a short-lived, and I'm not sure why it didn't last as long as the wool mission was an animal byproduct. But that lasted a long time, and so did the cotton mission, which was a plant product, both used for textiles and manufacturing clothing. I'm not sure why. I don't know the details of the hemp manufacturing. Perhaps it's more difficult to do, and it may have needed more chemicals, which they would have had to import, and that might have diminished the appeal of trying to manufacture locally grown hemp into locally manufactured clothing.
Did they actually try to grow that here in Utah then?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did it last into the 20th century?
No. In fact, none of these did. The cotton and the wool church-owned businesses basically ended around the turn of the century in the early 1900s. And so the clothing manufacturing that did continue for a period of time with general authority and church investment didn't depend on church-grown products, whether it was wool or whether it was cotton. By the time of the early 20th century, there was a secularization that was beginning, and so the church products were often shipped to distant locations that had little or no Mormon population, and they were importing products, raw materials as well. So the effort at being totally self-sufficient really ended around the 1880s, not long after the death of Brigham Young.
Okay, so the 1880s, that's good to know. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Michael Quinn. In our next conversation, we'll talk about tithing specifically and talk about how much money the church makes. We'll also ask if general authorities are expected to pay tithing.
Somebody who is a church general authority, for example, who has no other source of income but what the church gives him, is still expected to pay 10% of that back to the church. Otherwise, and I've seen the PBO reports, he is defined as a part or no tithe payer.
Wow. Did they take away his temple recommend?
Right. It could happen.
Oh, wow.
And it wouldn't be the first time that a general authority has been threatened with being dropped from office for one reason or another.
I hope you enjoyed that short clip from our next interview. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please go to our patreon.com/gospeltangents and subscribe for just $5 a month. If you'd like a transcript of this, please click the yellow subscribe button at gospeltangents.com, and I'll send you this and all future transcripts. Also, if you'd like a paperback like we've got here, those are available at our website at amazon.com. Just do a search for Gospel Tangents. Please get all updates at our Facebook page at facebook.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter at Gospel Tangents. You can also get transcripts individually at our website, gospeltangents.com/shop. Finally, make sure that you subscribe on our Apple Podcast page. Just do a quick search for Gospel Tangents there and give us a 5-star review while you're at it. Thanks again for listening. Your support helps create more Mormon history classes and podcasts such as this, and so I really appreciate you listening. Please share with your friends. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our great videos. Thanks again.